Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
You're looking a lot more fresh than you sounded like last week, Matt.
Yeah, I feel a bit
normally,
more fresh.
Normally it's the other way around, isn't it?
Is it?
Oh, you used to joke that I'd say you look like shit.
No, you used to say I look like shit.
Yeah, now I'm saying you don't.
Right, okay.
It's amazing
I wasn't joking.
No, it's amazing what one extra week of downtime actually can do for you. Because I know, don't know about you, but I absolutely needed that.
Yeah, I did too. And yes, it wouldn't have been an option recording any time between last Wednesday and now anyway.
That's fine. But we probably should kick off with an apology for missing last week. First time in just over 3 years, or coming up to 4 years, I think it is now, 73 episodes deep. That was the first time we missed a drop. Sorry, just over 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the first time we missed a drop.
Yeah.
But
it's not bad,
as I've just been going through our backlog now, I did notice that we actually were one up. So we released an intermediate episode back for the first AdaConf.
Yeah. We also released a bonus episode for is the .NET ecosystem in crisis?
Oh, was that a bonus one too? So we've got another one up our sleeve.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll see you next week.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. I wouldn't say a tough slog, but it is quite an effort to make sure that we don't miss an episode. And I was quite proud of the fact that we got that far. But I think, well, me personally speaking, I did get to a point where there was just so much going on, I needed a bit of a break.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. I don't think it's just me. Like, I know, like, obviously with the pandemic and everything over the past few years, people have been saying, you know, times are tough, and they have been. But maybe it's just me, but I really feel like this year has just been a really hard year for everyone.
No, that's not just you. Yeah. I'm feeling it. Like, we're feeling it. Feeling it at work, feeling it at home. Like, it's a tough year.
Yeah.
It just it feels like you're fighting uphill.
Yeah.
But let's not...
But you do that for fun, don't you?
Oh, no. Let's lighten the mood.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's lighten the mood. Again, looking back through the backlog, there's been a few episodes that to me have stood out, and I think have stood out in the metrics too, in the analytics that we can see. And those are the ones where you bamboozle us with your knowledge of history around all things tech. So I'm thinking the episodes like the history of UI in .NET.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking about was it the history of auth, or was it just auth from the ground up?
There was the what do you know about auth, yeah.
What do you know about auth? That's the one. Like episodes like that, those have resonated with the audience, and they've, like I said, you just bamboozled me with the random knowledge that you have around our industry.
Yeah.
Other topics on hand that you might want to talk about?
It's funny you should ask, because... I was looking into something recently. In fact, I wrote a post on my blog, and I haven't publicized it or shared it widely because it does need a part two. And also, it's quite long. It's like a long form essay. It's like 4,000 words. So I want to get the part two done and then like provide a summary of each, and then maybe people can look at that. So, but I did while researching that, I did dive into the history of GPUs and CPUs. And I did know a bit about them, and now I know a bit more. I mean, I'm not an engineer, so I'm not a CPU engineer, so I don't, you know, I'm not a, you know, a semiconductor engineer, so I don't know deep technical things about them, but I have learned a bit about the history, some of which I already knew, and some of it, you know, uncovered some interesting stories.
Yeah.
And yeah, I found it really interesting because I obviously love all this shit, so I thought I'd talk through that a bit.
No, I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah. So thinking back to one of the other I nerd out about tech history episodes, there was the one on VR, and I don't know if you remember, but I did talk about how there was a turning point in graphics technology, which was shaders.
Yep.
I don't know if I went too much into what that means, so I'm going to talk about a bit of the background about that and how we got here and what that means, and you know, everyone's favorite topic that we're not talking about today, it really does impact that, and it
crypto.
Impacts sorry yeah
crypto.
Exactly, crypto. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, Superman's dog. I think what's really interesting is, I think thinking back to, you may remember some of this from the acquired episode on Microsoft as well, when they were talking about the history of CPUs, because they did there. But think back to like the 80s, you know, when we first started getting into, you know, computers and programming. I don't know if that's true for you, but certainly the IBM compatible, you know, Wintel platform was big and was common, but it wasn't the only player in town, right? So, you know, people used to have Amstrads. They used to have, I had an Amiga, people had Ataris. There was, when in the school that I was, we spoke of this actually, the school that I was in, we had these BBC micro computers. There was Acorn, was a big education computer. And they're not in my notes actually, and they should be, because they're a major part of this history. A major part of today, like their history is a major part of today. But excuse me, the Amiga processor was the 680 series, 680XO series from Motorola.
Yep.
And that's what drove the Amiga. Now, of course, the Amiga was different from other computers at the time because it actually did have dedicated graphics and sound chips. So that's kind of what made it different. You know, all the other computers had like whatever processor. So Amiga was really ahead of its time. The graphics, the sound. I remember I had a friend from school that, you know, he would play a game that on his DOS computer, and I had the same game. I think it was Rick Dangerous, actually. But yeah, I remember he came over and he'd never heard the sound before. He didn't know that, he didn't even know there was music in the game because he didn't have a sound card. So on PC, you had to buy a sound card, right?
Yeah. Sound Blaster.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Creative.
Yeah.
So yeah, so the Amiga was different because, you know, it, like before all that, kind of had, it had these chips built. It had dedicated chips for graphics and sound and, you know, a couple of other things. But like, it was, yeah, like for as a gaming machine, it was way ahead of the competition. So like the big competition at the time was not really the PC market. And PC gaming wasn't that big. The big competition was from the home consoles like Sega and Nintendo. So you had like the Mega Drive and the SNES around that era, well, before that, you know, the NES and the Master System, what have you. And the Amiga kind of blew those out the water, and it wasn't particularly successful. There's a couple of documentaries on this if anyone's interested, but, you know, a lot of mismanagement at Commodore. But then something happened, right? A specific moment in history that changed the equation of what I just said. And I said that PC gaming wasn't big at the time, and there was something that happened that made, literally made PC gaming, like, you know, there have been PC games before, but it put PC gaming on the map. It made PC gaming the aspirational, gaming machine. And it still is, like, even today, like, if you are a hardcore gamer, the top tier gaming experience is PC. That hasn't changed. Like, none of the consoles, you know, none of the consoles, I was going to say they don't come close. They actually do, but that's a whole other thing. Anyway, so there was something that happened that kind of put PC to the forefront of gaming. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No. I mean, my first instinct was something like the release of Doom or...
Yes.
Yeah?
Correct. But, yes.
I mean, there were games before then on the PC, right? Wolfenstein predated Doom.
It did, yeah. Wolfenstein 3D.
Yeah.
Being the one you're talking about, not the original.
Yeah.
Return to Castle Wolfenstein.
Yeah.
But yes.
Wolfenstein... those games predated Doom, but Doom was the pivotal turning point for PC gaming.
It was Doom was huge, and it changed the landscape of gaming. Like, that became the benchmark. And, you know, for a long time I really felt that like Doom was what killed the Amiga. And I remember that at the time there was such a big push in the Amiga community, can we get Doom to work on Amiga, can we get Doom to run on the Amiga? And like, they just couldn't, right? And at the time there was a big push for what were called FPUs, floating point units. And basically, you just couldn't get them to work, right? And like, the Amiga died because of management issues at Commodore, but the Doom never made it to the Amiga during the Amiga's original life run. And I remember, you know, for years, I always kind of thought that the downfall of the Amiga was its inability to, you know, do floating point operations and consequently, therefore, run Doom. And I'll tell you something interesting that I learned, right? Turns out that's not strictly true, because something that I learned while researching this is that Doom uses integer maths only.
Yep. So I remember reading an article or something a while back that one of the biggest breakthroughs for Doom was, like, for 3D graphics, you have to calculate, like, you're calculating a lot of, as you said, floating point integers, floating point numbers.
Yeah.
there's an oxymoron. Yeah. Floating point numbers, right? But I can't remember the name of the engineer, but he's figured out a way to approximate with relatively high accuracy, but in a lot fewer steps, those same calculations. And in doing so, actually made the 3D rendering viable. And it was without that sort of approximation, it was absolutely not possible.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, John Carmack is celebrated as a genius. And the whole of the Doom source, Doom is open source. You can read the source code.
Mm.
But like, yeah, John Carmack is this really blew my mind. Like, I knew that he was a genius, but I really didn't appreciate to what extent. I mean, what he did, like, if you think about PCs, like when Doom came out, you know, like the 386 CPU, the Intel 386 CPU dominated.
Mm-hmm.
The 486, you know, would run it comfortably. I'm pretty sure there were people running Doom on a 386. No, I'm not even pretty sure there were, right? I don't know if you could run it on a 286. I should look that up. But yeah, like, you know, what he did was, I mean, obviously what he wanted to do was write the floating point math and be able to actually approximate 3D space.
Mm.
Right. And have his code that would model 3D space and then figure out a way of rendering it. But he didn't, and he couldn't. And the thing is that what he did was basically he looked at the limitations, and the limitations are what fueled the innovation.
Yep.
The constraints are what fueled the innovation. Yeah. He looked at the limitations, and he didn't want to create a game that would only run on top tier hardware. He wanted to create a game that everyone could run, so he did. And like, yeah, like one of the major compromises was yaw. I'm trying to remember which one. So roll, pitch, and yaw. I think it's the yaw.
Yep.
So the looking up and down.
Yep.
Or is that pitch?
That's pitch.
It's pitch. Sorry, it's pitch. Yeah. So there's no pitch, right? And that was one of the compromises. But yeah, like essentially, it's not actually rendering 3D. He approximated it. And yeah, I guess we don't need to go through the whole thing, because I mean, maybe I would like to. I just don't think we have time right now. And I haven't, sorry, when I say I would like to, I mean, I would like to read through his code, and I haven't. I've like dipped into it and looked at bits of it.
Yeah.
And it's all very, very, like, so well written. It's very legible. Like, you know, you can read it and understand it. And maybe we'll go through it. We definitely don't have time now. But yeah, like, you know, it's not actually a model of 3D space in the way that modern games are. It's an approximation that lets you create a game that gives the impression of movement through 3D. And of course, there was no, like, all the enemies were sprites. There were 2D yep. characters on screen. And, you know, then you had to, you know, they didn't, I don't know how much scaling they did, but they probably had, you know, you had to animate the sprite and draw them in every position and every angle, and probably at different scales. So a lot of incredible, incredible smart innovation went into that. So it's not that the lack of floating point killed Amiga, because it didn't need it. Because, like, god damn. So yeah, so I just, like, yeah, mind-blowing, I think. Like, mind-blowing. Anyway, so around this time, what was it, 1993? I think it came out in 1993, the original Doom. And I think he open-sourced it in 97.
93, yeah.
Yeah. So 1993, you know, you've got the death of basically 16-bit gaming in general. Motorola chips are still around, and a lot of other chips are still around. What was interesting was, you know, the PC market was, nowadays we think it's Nvidia and AMD, but there was another player in the space around that time called Cyrix. I don't know if you remember them.
No.
They were very, very cheap and cheerful. So the Cyrix processor was basically a cheap Intel alternative, right?
Mm.
So it wasn't like it was, you know, it was compatible with the same motherboards that the Intel Pentium and, you know, processors would go into. Excuse me. And Cyrix could very comfortably play Doom as well.
Yep.
But then what it couldn't do was floating point operations. And 3 years after Doom came out, Quake came out.
Yep.
And Quake did use floating point math.
And Quake was full 3D. Yeah.
You had full 3D, and it was different. You had so you could look, and you had full sixed off motion, so 6 degrees of freedom, so you could move in 3 axes and look in 3 axes, right? So that's the six mm-hmm. degrees. And, you know, it was a full 3D model, and the actual enemies were 3D objects as well.
Yeah.
So you needed floating point operations for that. So at this point, we're well beyond Amiga. Like, but yeah, the Cyrix CPUs couldn't do it. I don't know if that's what killed Cyrix. There is an interesting few articles about the history of Cyrix. There's a Tech Spot Gone But Not Forgotten article. Maybe we'll link to that. It's quite interesting. So I won't rehash the whole thing here. But I just think it's interesting that, you know, we think that, you know, AMD and Intel, but there was, you know, there was a third once. I'd be interested. There is something tickling the back of my mind to say that there were there were other minor players that didn't survive as well, but I can't remember who they were. So if anyone does, you know, feel free to let us know. But, you know, like, I mean, you know, the inability to play Quake was definitely a big nail in the coffin for Cyrix. Like, that was, yeah, that was an important part of the market to the PC gaming market at the time. So, yeah, so Cyrix. Now, I mentioned earlier, Acorn. So the computer, the chips that we're talking about, that we're describing, which is like the Intel, the AMD, the Cyrix, they are what's known as complex instruction set computing processors, otherwise known as CISC.
Yeah.
Right. So there is another type of processor called RISC, which is reduced instruction set computing.
Yeah.
And the concept with RISC is that it's more efficient, and that, you know, they're not burdened with legacy. They don't have to carry all these other instruction sets that they don't need. Right.
Yep. Yeah.
So they were cheaper, faster, lower energy, so on and so forth. And Acorn, which were primarily targeted at education, and in fact, I don't know if they sold to anyone other than schools. They also invented the middle mouse button, by the way, Acorn.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Acorn Archimedes we had in our school. So they were RISC computers, and they were very good. They were very popular. RISC didn't take off. It looked like it kind of became popular for a while, but it didn't really take off, and it kind of wasn't something people had heard of. And, you know, like, people, you know, in the late 90s, you would hear people talking with excitement about RISC machines, but then you didn't hear much of it. But they didn't go away, and in fact, they are the most common type of CPU in the world, because the R in ARM is RISC. Mm. So advanced RISC microprocessor. So advanced reduced instruction set computing microprocessor. So ARM CPUs are RISC. So they've obviously been around for, they blew up in a big way when smartphones took off. But then there's, of course, the SBC, single board computers. And now they're having a big surge in the desktop or laptop, whatever, in the personal computing space, because Apple Silicon is ARM, is all ARM RISC CPUs. Now, of course, you've got Windows on ARM, so all the other competitors are. Now, interestingly, this is a detour into now, but the current generation of CISC CPUs from Intel and AMD are also incredibly efficient and low power, and can kind of compete with ARM on battery life. Not like, you know, ARM is going to win, but, you know, like, not.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking the difference between like maybe 7 or 10 hours and 12 hours, rather than, you know, 2 hours and 10 hours and 12 hours on a battery, right? Yep. So yeah, they've come a long way. But yeah, like, that was obviously the big thing of RISC, and it kind of went away, and, you know, it's kind of having a big resurgence. But yeah, like, Cyrix didn't survive. AMD did, but, you know, obviously Intel has up until really Apple Silicon really dominated the CPU market. Like, you're about to say something.
No, I mean, up until Apple Silicon, but I haven't been much of the, or paying too much attention to the CPU market. But I mean, these days AMD are pretty much up there too now, aren't they? Like, they've overtaken Intel, from my understanding.
Yeah, so I think this is a bit of a detour, but back when I used to work in, you know, computer retail, we would find generally, like, because I used to work sales as well as like support.
Yep.
And we would generally find that, based on what people were returning and, you know, having repaired and replaced and that sort of thing, that the Intel CPUs, which were more expensive, were very reliable.
Yep.
The AMD CPUs were cheaper and they were faster, but they would live fast and die young, we would say.
Yeah. Okay.
So they would outperform the Intel CPUs, but they just weren't as reliable. They would cark it.
Yep.
And, you know, now in retrospect, I can see that wasn't just us. That was definitely the pattern. And I think that reputation lingered for a long time with AMD. And I think maybe even unfairly today still does.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, like, yes, the AMD CPUs, it's the competitive duopoly arms race you would expect it to be, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're neck and neck.
It's like Boeing and Airbus.
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, Boeing were the leaders, and then Airbus sort of come up behind and have slowly taken over the lead, because they're like Boeing or Intel have squandered the lead that they had.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think with Boeing it's a different story and interesting for different reasons, but that's because of the cost plus model and the government contracts, but that's a whole other
another topic anyway, for another day.
Although the underlying mechanisms are the same, which is the constraints forcing innovation. But yes, anyway, so back to kind of the late 90s, right? So Quake So Doom ran on, you know, it was like, it was planar graphics, not FPU. It ran on like 386s basically, but it was when Quake came along and that did have floating points, and Cyrix would run at like 15 frames per second. It run, like, just couldn't handle Quake.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But Quake was probably the last game of that era of the, you know, this, you buy the latest, you know, you buy the latest Pentium and you can run Quake, right?
Mm-hmm.
So nowadays, like, you know, games are released and they're released, you can tweak the graphics and you can play them on lower end hardware. But, you know, for a long time, if you wanted to buy and play the latest games, you needed to invest in an additional piece of hardware for your computer, which we've been describing as an FPU,
yep,
floating point unit. And then they came to be known as graphics cards,
mm-hmm,
which came to be known as what we know today as GPU, right?
Yep.
And what's interesting, so this is the kind of 1996 to 2000 era, and this is the real transition to 3D graphics. And this is when, you know, things changed. And I think looking at the games console market, you know, you had like the games consoles had the same problem Amiga did, right? They were great 2D machines, but you know, you couldn't run 3D games on the SNES, you couldn't run 3D games on the Mega Drive.
Mm-hmm.
Then of course Nintendo and Sega wanted to transition into the 32-bit era and release 32-bit consoles. Sega did, like, they had an add-on for the Mega Drive, the 32X. That was a joke. Atari released a console called the Jaguar, which was a 64-bit console.
Yeah,
that was a disaster. But yeah, Sega launched the Saturn. Yep. Console, which I desperately, desperately wanted back in the day because I wanted to play Virtua Cop. I used to love that in the arcade. And then, of course, Time Crisis. Quick aside, I may have mentioned this already. There's a game in VR now called Aim Assault, which is basically Time Crisis in, yes, VR. It's, yeah, fucking, yeah, amazing. I love it. It's so good. Anyway, so Sega launched the Saturn, and it wasn't particularly successful. And I think 3D gaming consoles all had something problematic in common at the time, which I'll get back to. Nintendo didn't launch their 32-bit console because they were partnering with another organization to develop it, and that partnership broke down, and that other organization went on to release that device under their own brand, and that was the PlayStation. So that's how the PlayStation came to be. And then, but the PlayStation, you know, the PlayStation was successful, the Saturn wasn't as successful. Nintendo skipped that 32-bit era altogether, and they came out swinging a couple of years later with the N64, the Nintendo 64. Yep. This was a completely different style of graphics. This was based on a chipset called the Power VR, which I'll come back to in a moment. But the thing that they introduced was that analog stick. I don't know if you remember the N64 controller, but it had like three prongs. So you had your traditional controller using, yep, the left and right,
yeah,
but then you could use the analog stick in the middle, and that was a game changer. And then Sony picked it up with the DualShock controller. Saturn never made it to analog sticks, but analog sticks are what made 3D gaming really possible without a mouse.
Yeah,
right. So it had worked. It worked with Doom, and it worked with Quake. Like, mouse and keyboard controls successful on PC. It didn't survive the transition to console until someone came along and said, you need an analog stick for this. And, you know, like, Nintendo were very successful with that, with the Super Mario 64, all of them, really. But, like, really, the Star Wars Shadows of the Empire game that people probably don't remember now really made good use of it. Mm-hmm. So that was game-changing. Anyway, the thing that I think was interesting about this era, that, and I said I'd come back to, was nowadays we think of GPUs as, you know, being a two-horse race between Team Red and Team Green, which is AMD, yep, and NVIDIA. But that wasn't always the case, right? So there used to be, I mean, the market used to be saturated. So back in the day, I had a graphics card called a Matrox Mystique. And the interesting thing about, again, like, the interesting thing about computers in general is that we forget that they've always been general purpose machines.
Mm.
Like, no one has ever, I mean, these days we do, like, but we have done, we've moved to it. But the historical move has been what the mass market is now, which is try and sell things to appeal to a broader market, because people aren't going to justify the spend for something that's just for gaming. But yeah, if it's general purpose, so like Matrox, the Matrox graphics cards were generally workstation graphics cards. They were kind of creatives, you know, rendering tools and that kind of stuff. Matrox Mystique was a workstation oriented graphics card that was capable of gaming. And I used it for that. Like, I used to do some video editing and a bit of 3D rendering back in the day. I enjoyed that. And I played games on it. It was great. Loved it. But the major player, the dominant player in the market, was 3DFX. That was the dominant graphics card during that period of time. And then Power VR came along, and just Power VR was much better, and it worked in a different way. And that was really the market that NVIDIA exploded into, right? So NVIDIA came along, and you know, and yes, they dominate now, but we kind of they didn't always. And I think something that's interesting that I want to come back to that I mentioned earlier, and I mentioned in the last episode, is the concept of shaders, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is the real game changer. So do you know what a shader is?
Yes, but not to a technical definition.
Let's pretend you don't know.
No, I have no idea what you're talking about when you say a shader.
Okay, so a shader is by definition a program that runs on the GPU. Like, that's it, right?
Okay.
What it meant from a gaming perspective, and the reason it's called a shader, is that, in fact, actually, let's take a step down lower level. Do you know what the difference is between a CPU and a GPU?
A CPU does a lot of different things, but not as efficiently, whereas a GPU can do sort of your floating point operations, as we discussed earlier, very specific floating point operations, but can do them quickly and in parallel.
It's the in parallel part that's actually what matters, right? So a CPU is made up of, you know, a small number of cores.
Yeah.
Those cores are quite large. And when I say large, I mean in terms of memory, their cache, right? And I mean, clock speed is not the fact. I mean, it is a factor, but it's not the defining factor here, right?
But I mean, the era that you're talking about, like if you go back 90s, early 2000s, when we were running single core CPUs, yes, clock speed was everything.
Oh, no, but I'm saying it's not the distinguishing factor between a GPU and a CPU. But yes.
No. But now, yes, you're right. Now, once they came up with multi-threading, or what they call it, hyper-threading in CPUs, and then multi-cores,
yeah,
the clock speed's far less of a critical measurement of your CPU these days.
Yes, yeah, that's very true. Yeah, I mean, and also they're all so freaking fast now. Anyway, that
yeah.
Actually, you know, how fast
do you need to render that spreadsheet?
That's right. But you know, like the other thing that's really interesting here is that there hasn't really been a major advance in CPU from a clock speed perspective technology for 10 years.
Yeah,
like we haven't seen. You know, we've been floating around that 2 to 4 gigahertz range for the average consumer for 10 years, right?
But there's no need to.
Exactly. There is no need. Like, they are fast enough. The innovations have been in efficiency, like, you know, driving that same speed, but at lower power consumption.
Mm.
And that's where the innovation has been. And it's been fantastic, right? But the difference between CPUs and GPUs is primarily a CPU has a small number of cores, and those cores are, call them large, and capable of doing big things and doing lots of big things, lots of different kinds of big things.
Yeah.
Right. A GPU is made up of orders of magnitude more cores. So, like the current generation AMD and NVIDIA GPUs, the consumer ones have thousands of cores.
Yeah.
Right. But those cores are tiny. They can't do very much. They can do one thing. They do it quickly, and you know that's it. It's done. Right. So this is why they're great for 3D graphics, because you need to calculate the vectors and positions of, well, thousands of points simultaneously, mm-hmm. every frame, multiple times a second. And they're really, really good at that. And CPUs are not. GPUs, not that great at anything else, or so people thought. And that was the difference. So the reason, so back to shaders, right? The reason they were called shaders was that what the technology did that was different was, if you think about how you might write code to simulate a 3D model or a 3D scene, you might calculate the positions of a bunch of different things. You might want to do ray tracing to calculate the lights and how you're going to render pixels on screen, so on and so forth. What shaders did was they allowed you to have rules that would define what each individual pixel would look like. That's why they were called pixel shaders originally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was a small piece of code that would run on the GPU that would offload all of that complexity just for one pixel at a time and just handle it one pixel at a time. And that's what shaders were, and that's why they're called shaders. But it's a program that run on the GPU. Now, what would happen back at the time is you would have to, if you released a game, you would have to release drivers, or you would have to release a game for the drivers or for the version that, and the graphics card that you had. So this is why at the time there was a graphics card war, and this is why things like Matrox didn't survive necessarily, 3DFX and PowerVR did, because at the time, you know, as a games company, there was no way that you could create a version of your game for each individual GPU plus the consoles and everything else. It was just not viable. And that's when a couple of technologies came along that changed it. One was DirectX from Microsoft. This was a Windows feature. And it was basically an abstraction the same way that like .NET is, right? Or Java is. So you as a GPU hardware manufacturer would create drivers that would allow DirectX to speak to your hardware.
Yeah.
And then programmers, game devs would write their code for DirectX.
Yeah.
There was another competing technology called OpenGL, Open Graphics Language or Library. I checked actually. So that became very popular as well. And that's still an ongoing thing. Both are still around and going strong. But yeah, the point is that as a game developer, you would create a version of your game that you would write your code to run on OpenGL. On OpenGL, then the hardware manufacturers would write their drivers that would allow that OpenGL code to run on their hardware. And that's why when you launch a game, it says compiling shaders. So I don't know if you're much into gaming, but this is one of the things that gamers talk about. The first time you launch a game, it says compiling shaders. What does that mean? It means that the code that the vendor, the game dev, has shipped to run on whatever graphics library it's running on, the shader language it's running on, is being compiled to the driver hardware from your vendor.
So they compile that at initial runtime.
Yep.
Interesting, because I just would have thought that they would run against the abstraction.
No, it's not fast enough.
Yeah.
It's not fast enough for a GPU, so it gets compiled. It gets AOT compiled the first time you run the game.
See, look, I'm learning. I tell you, I'm learning something every time I listen to one of these episodes. I mean, record one of these episodes.
Yeah. So I thought that was really interesting. Now, where it becomes innovative and then also bites us all in the ass is that people started thinking, well, what else can you do with them, right? Because if a shader language is arbitrary code, and what you got to remember here is, again, the constraint is what drove the innovation, right? So the shader languages weren't general purpose computing languages like the ones that we could run on, at least at a higher level, on CPUs. And again, the constraints of the small operations that you do in parallel changes what you do. But this turned out to obviously be game changer for research. Like if you think about, well, neural net computing, but like any kind of number crunching, really. So academia, it became huge. It also is what let us do crypto.
Yep.
And it's why they are so in demand for AI. It literally is what lets AI exist. And it has been the case since long before LLMs. Like AI research has always been done on neural nets and GPUs. Because they're very good at it, they're efficient for it. You know, like there's a whole, you know, the languages are around it. Like, you know, we think about like tensors. It's all GPU math, right? So that's kind of what happened, really, and that's what's brought us to where we are today. Now, of course, all the GPU technology has been bought up and by the data centers, and the prices have been going more and more out of control. You know, NVIDIA. So a top of the range NVIDIA GPU, which is a 5090 today, if you can get one, how much do you think they cost?
Oh, shit. I don't know. $2,000.
You would think, yeah. They're about $6,000.
Shit.
Yeah.
And that's just a supply and demand thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not because of technology. It's a supply and demand thing.
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. It's not just supply and demand. I did mention quite a long essay I wrote about AI and a lot of this stuff. It's not just supply and demand. It's also bigger market forces than that. I don't necessarily want to go into that now. But if it was supply and demand, the prices would come back down, and they don't ever come back down. But that's what takes us to where we go next. And I think what's really interesting is, you know, like obviously NVIDIA absolutely dominate the GPU market today.
Mm-hmm.
Gamers predominantly want NVIDIA silicon, and you know, like they like NVIDIA have a technology called CUDA. That's their current technology, the RTX technology. AMD have their drivers are called RockM, and it runs on what they call their RDNA hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, like the AMD cards are just as good and can do everything the NVIDIA ones can do, except for one thing that they can't do as well, which is ray tracing. It's not really a defining factor. And I think if you look at the sentiment among gamers over the past probably 5 years, most of them would probably prefer to switch to AMD. Yeah. But AMD, you know, had a lot of goodwill. They've kind of lost that through really failure to capitalize on the goodwill, like literally more than anything else, to be honest. Like, you know, that's a whole other thing. So What's interesting from this article, and I am going to lean back on it now, the one that I wrote, is that we said earlier that the Intel have been dethroned. They don't dominate.
I was going to say that. Because I don't know if this is where you're going, but I've seen headlines recently about their latest GPU offerings.
Well, that's the interesting thing, right, is that Intel have kind of snuck up on everyone and quietly been, I mean, they've been selling these Arc GPUs for years, and they've kind of been cheap and cheerful, and they still are. They are now quietly the best value for money GPUs you can get. They're still not the best GPUs, but they are the best value for money.
Yeah, that's what I've been saying.
Like the latest B70 series is like 32 gig. So that NVIDIA RTX 5090 that I mentioned, 32 gig of VRAM, $6,000. AMD GPUs, the last generation ones, which was the 7900, there was the XT and the XTX. The XTX, which was the top of the line, is only 24 gig, which that's where it tops out. They don't even make those anymore. The new ones, which is the 9700 XT range, they max out at 16. So if you want a current generation card above 16 gig, your choice is NVIDIA or Intel. And like the Intel ones are $2,000 for the 32 gig B70, and that's like a third of the NVIDIA.
So
now it's from a non-gamers.
Sorry,
it's not. I was going to say it's not all down to just how much VRAM you get, although that is a big factor. Like for AI in particular, like more VRAM means bigger context.
That's where I was going to go, right? Because you know I'm not too familiar with the gaming industry, but do you need more than 16 gig VRAM for modern games?
It depends, but no.
Maybe like it's from a consumer's point of view, from a gamer's point of view, you don't need to be fighting the prices for those big 32 gig cards because they're all being taken by those that are running AI workloads.
Yeah. I mean, that's the sentiment, and that's what people are doing. I mean, from a gaming perspective, there's diminishing returns above 16 gig. Yeah. I mean, you're not going to drive higher resolution than what your monitor can do. You're not going to drive higher refresh rate than what your monitor can do. Like this is a whole other conversation around what's happened to the middle market around consumer tech, in particular monitors. But let me ask you a quick question. What do you think the refresh rate of a monitor needs to be?
I don't play games.
No, not for games. What for you?
I don't know. 30? 40?
Yeah.
30 FPS?
Frames per second? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So most monitors now will be 60.
Yep.
Gamers like to push all the way up to like 244 or even 300.
Shit.
Obviously, your eyes can't see that fast.
No.
In fact, you know, like movies and TV ran at 24 frames per second for decades.
I mean, that's always been my reference. And then,
yeah.
I mean, when I bought my first TV, I think that was a 100 hertz TV.
Yeah. Now, there are a whole bunch of reasons why you might want a faster refresh rate monitor. Really, it's bragging rights, to be honest. If you're a pro esports gamer, there are arguments about eye strain, motion blur, but also it's actually the frame rate actually constrains everything else that happens. So a faster refresh rate isn't just about what you see, but like how responsive your mouse movements are.
Yep.
And you can actually prove this yourself, right? So if you write a program that's going to like, you know, iterate through a bunch of numbers and write them all out to the screen and finish after like 60 seconds, if you do the same thing, but then don't write them to the screen, the one that doesn't write to the screen will get through more numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So it constrains everything. So yeah, so but the point is from a gaming perspective, once you know, unless you're really pushing that top tier competitive esports level, there's real diminishing returns above that 16 gig. And I think that what most people want from a gaming perspective is 1440p. That's the resolution, so or 2K or QHD as you call it, at like 100 hertz or 120 hertz, 144 maybe, and your 16 gig cards can do that, but they're still absurdly expensive. Like the NVIDIA ones are over $2,000. It's absolutely fucking insane. Now, we might be thinking, well, Intel are here to save the day. Unfortunately, Intel have announced that they are no longer making any gaming GPUs after the current generation. So the next generations will all be for local inference. However, they are still the best value for money. And there's one thing that I've said repeatedly throughout this conversation, and it's true way beyond the context of this conversation, and that is that innovation is driven by the constraints. And all those researchers and all those crypto bros and all those AI researchers that came along and said, well, these are gaming graphics cards, but we're going to use them for crypto and research and writing AI. I'm pretty sure there are gamers out there that are going to use these new generations of Intel cards to innovate and like make them run games, even if it's they're not supposed to. So I'm, you know, I think we are going back to more players coming in. And I think, you know, I've been waffling on for a long time, but I'll just finish by saying there are actually two other players emerging in this space. There's a guy who's a big name, really, in the history of CPUs and GPUs. His name is Jim Keller, and he worked on the Apple, the antecedents of the current Apple Silicon CPUs. Mm-hmm. He's worked on NVIDIA GPUs. He's worked on a whole bunch of stuff. He is now working for a company called TensTorrent, and they make competitive GPUs also aimed at the AI market rather than gaming, but it's an open source architecture. And it's also, again, it's driven by constraints. It changes the architecture of GPUs to do things differently, to be able to do things better and cheaper than the way that we do them now.
Yeah.
There's another player who is emerging in this space as well. And I'm looking it up because I can't remember off the top of my head. I actually saw it. I only came across this yesterday, and it was on the Gamers Nexus YouTube channel. Let me see if I can find it. But again, it's another consumer focused GPU that's starting to emerge, and their focus is that mid market. That maybe this is a conversation for another episode, but that's kind of the part that's dropped out. And I think we're all being funneled now into this choice between something cheap and disposable, or something off the fucking charts expensive. So, I don't think that's where we're being left. I think that there are people emerging to that space, and the GPU market is certainly one example of it.
It almost doesn't surprise me that there's new players in the market.
Yeah.
Right. There's that, you know, the saying, to make money in a gold rush, you gotta sell troubles.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there is absolutely no doubt in the world we're in a gold rush right now, which is why Nvidia are just going through the roof. And obviously there's money to be made. There's a gap in the market. And as you said, as everyone's chasing that big pot of gold in the AI market, well, that opens up the gap for the gaming market.
It does, yeah, because the traditional suppliers to that market have abandoned that market, the very market that put them where they are today, and that's why gamers are pissed off.
And that's it. So it's like, if you look at it, take a step back and look at it, it's not surprising to see so many new players, but whether or not they will last and whether or not they have, I think that would be based on if they have a product worth buying. You know, obviously they do need a product that, like, people are not going to throw money at a shitty shovel, are they?
No, they will. They will.
They will once or twice, but then you're going to go out of business.
But by the sixth or seventh time...
But so, look, I think you're right. Like, it'd be interesting to see where we go from here. But the other thing too, with if we take crypto as history, right, the crypto market moved away from GPUs and towards what do you call them? They were more programmable
FPGAs.
FPGAs, that's the one.
Yeah, did they?
I thought they did. That was my recollection, or that was my interpretation. Sorry?
I thought the crypto market basically just died out.
Well, I think it was a bit of both.
Right.
Is my recollection.
FPGAs are very cool, by the way.
Field programmable gate arrays, is that it?
Yes, field programmable gate arrays. Yeah. It's a programmable CPU, as in the architecture of the CPU is, well, field programmable.
Yeah.
So a CPU is a gate array, right? It's an array of logic gates. Yeah.
But they're just general purpose.
Yeah. So and typically they're like arranged at a hardware level in a certain configuration.
Mm.
So an FPGA. An FPGA, like, actually the architecture of the CPU itself is programmable. And that's why they're really popular in the retro gaming scene, because it's not an emulator. Like, it's literally you are configuring the hardware to be the hardware that you're emulating. Yeah. It's cool. And in fact, the guy whose name I can't remember, and the company I can't remember, that's designing these new GPUs, they're actually doing all their testing on FPGAs. So, like, everything that they're doing runs like orders of magnitude slower than it will on their actual hardware.
Yeah,
because they want to actually get their
architecture right first.
Their architecture right, and their shader framework and everything else.
Yep.
So they've got their own shader language, you know, target And they've been working with Blender and other people to actually just even not it's not about performance. It's like, does it work the way that we expect it to with our architecture?
Yep.
And before they start committing to it. So they're really working with the industry. Anyway, sorry, random other tangent about FPGAs.
I mean, it's that old analogy, right? Make it work, make it right, make it fast.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? And they're just at that make it work stage. Just get it to work. Then they'll tweak it to make it right on their actual hardware, and then they'll make it fast.
Yeah, exactly.
So does that bring us to the current dilemma we're in now, where we're paying too much for GPUs, can't get our hands on them, and have to make do with last year's technology?
I think that the last part of what you said there is true, more true than the rest of it, because last year's technology is way more than good enough, right?
Yep.
You know, we're not paying too much because we're just not doing it. And like, this is the thing, is like we spoke earlier about the law of supply and demand, but I mean, I guess the demand is being fulfilled by the data centers building the AI rigs and what have you. But I mean, by and large...
Was it you that was saying maybe last episode or a couple of episodes back where the actual providers, the cloud providers, have the GPUs just sitting there in stock waiting? They just don't have the facilities to plug them into?
It was RAM, not GPUs. But
RAM.
Yeah. So I just found this guy, it's Bolt Graphics, they're called. So I did find it. But yeah, I mean, basically people just like this is what I'm saying about like the bin, this is a whole other conversation around the mid-market, right? But there used to be a spectrum of you can pay a little, you can pay a lot, and then there's a range in between. That range in between has basically disappeared.
Yeah.
And we can theorize that the vendors have decided that people will basically pay more and all go to the top end. Or we can theorize that they don't care. Or we can theorize that disposable income for the middle class has just gone. So the market has disappeared of its own accord. So they've stopped catering to it. I don't know. That's a whole other interesting discussion. But what hasn't happened is people have not. They're just not like consumers are not paying these prices.
Mm.
Like it's just not happening. And I think there's a very, very separate conversation, but I think we are coming out the end of a 25-year consumerism craze that I mean, if you think about it, it's just insane to think that the fact that we buy a new $2,500 phone every year, even every 2 years, you know, people just not do it like we used to.
Yeah.
But the prices have crossed that threshold and people are now keeping their phones for 5 years, 10 years.
Yeah.
Right. So the same thing happened to tablets earlier, and it's now happening to the computer market, the laptop market. The right to repair movement is having its moment, but this is a whole other conversation. But the point is that people are not paying more. That they're not settling for last year's technology. They're happy with it. And in gaming specifically, there's another phenomenon as well, which is people looking at the games that came out 10 years ago, and they're looking at the games that come out now, and saying, not only why doesn't this game look 10 years better, but why does it require 10 years newer hardware that costs 10 times as much?
Yeah.
And, you know, retro gaming is having a moment at the moment. You know, it's like basically consumers are voting with their wallets and their wallets are not following the big bucks. They're going the other way. And that's
why
the market...
Is that not a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Where consumers don't want to pay the inflated prices from NVIDIA. Therefore, NVIDIA are like, well, screw that. There's no money to be made in that gaming market. We're going to ignore them. But the reason say, people would, are not...
I would say it's a vicious cycle more than a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
But NVIDIA are quite happy to ignore the gaming market. I mean, I argued this in my essay that I mentioned. Like, there's a very popular opinion that Jensen Huang has said that he's not interested in gamers anymore. And it's not true. He hasn't said that. In fact, he has said the exact opposite. But then actions speak louder than words. And NVIDIA certainly are voting with their wallets, and they certainly are not demonstrating that gamers are their core focus. You know, the AI market is.
Yep.
You know, the most telling thing out of all of this was the announcement of the RTX Spark with Microsoft. And that's the end user edge inference. Mm-hmm. Technology, and that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, it's not gaming, right?
Yep.
And I think that, you know, there's a vacuum, and we're seeing things fill in that vacuum, as is what you'd expect, and that's the market force. And I think, and again, going back to that essay that I write, like the prices do normalize, but they don't normalize from the same vendor. Like Intel's CPUs, Intel are not the dominant player in that space anymore, but they have not responded by lowering the prices of their CPUs.
Mm.
They just sell fewer of them and put the prices up. And like the same thing with with NVIDIA, and the same thing with AMD actually as well. You see the same things in other markets. Like look at Apple were the prime example of this. Like when they get to the end of life of one of their products or get to the launch of a new product, they recall it all and destroy it.
Yeah.
They don't sell it cheap. That prices just don't come down. But what happens instead is someone else comes along and fills that void. And that's what's happened in CPU market. It's what's happening in the GPU market. Already happened in the smartphone market.
Mm-hmm. Just needed to happen in the RAM market.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, that's a very different
situation
because it's about commodities that are controlled by a small handful of players.
Yeah.
Like, as in literally the rare earth minerals that are required to build the stuff. But yes, it doesn't...
From what I've heard too, it's not even that. It's also the small number of foundries that can manufacture the memory chips.
Yeah, that word, it is that. It's exactly
right. The investments for them to scale up, to add extra machines to scale up, they're just looking at going, but if this bubble bursts, then we're going to waste our money. So we're not going to invest that money.
Yeah. And I actually do think RAM prices will come down because this is the thing is like RAM is not, it's not a prestige item in the way that an NVIDIA GPU is.
Yeah.
Like there are, like, yes, there are a small number, but there are enough of them to keep each other competitive. So I do think RAM prices will come down.
But then I guess the RAM companies, they don't have that competitive advantage that, say, NVIDIA has over AMD.
That's right. Yeah.
In the GPU space, right?
Yeah. But, you know, the thing is,
NVIDIA have the CUDA cores, which are heavily leveraged and very efficient in the LLM space, right?
Well, it's actually not that the CUDA cores... Heavily leveraged, yes. It's not that they're that much better than the RDNA or the ROCm. The CUDA is better than ROCm. It's just that the tooling is better adapted to them.
Yeah.
And I think with the prices going the way they are, and you know, especially the investment that NVIDIA's, that AMD is putting into the ROCm architecture, and especially with Bolt and TensTorrent and the other players coming along, like NVIDIA's grip of the data center GPU market is not. It's not, you know, untoppable, for want of a better. Yeah, and it's not secure. I don't think it's secure. I think, again, like Intel, like the ARC architecture is like, it's really good and it's really good value for money. But again, the problem is the tooling isn't adapted to it. But Intel are actively investing in that. And like, you know, their commitment to their next gen being a pure local inference technology signals exactly that investment. And I don't think NVIDIA are going to be the long-term winners here. And that's why they're trying to secure the next 10 years by their partnership with Microsoft to be the on-device co-pilot processor.
Yeah.
The default de facto. That's their play for the next 5 to 10 years. It's not CUDA. It's not gaming. And it's not data center AI. That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah. Well, we kicked off this episode earlier, Matt, saying that it was time to learn something new.
I learned something old.
You learned something old. I've learned something, quite a few things tonight. But what I have learned is that it's well past my bedtime.
Yes, true.
So I saw you were drinking, Matt. Was it a red wine?
It was. It was an Oakvale Shiraz.
Oakvale, nice. Back to your old favorite. Back to your old favorite, eh? Still
is. Yeah, I'm still going. I got to finish this before bedtime. But yes, I probably shouldn't, but I will. And you are drinking Mountain Culture.
Mountain Culture. Have you been up there?
No.
Blue Mountains?
I've been to the Blue Mountains, but yes. Not to...
Mountain Culture. Pub. Nice little brewery up there. Yeah. So that was the Status Quo Pale Ale. It's quite easy to drink pale.
Yeah.
You know what I haven't done for a long time? And that's a brew. And I need to do one.
Weren't you saying a couple of episodes ago that you got a brew on?
No. My kegs are empty and they need to be filled. Actually, that's what I did. I sent you a screenshot. I asked Claude to put me together a recipe.
I remember that. Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't done anything with it yet, but I might. I'll have my first AI-driven AI-driven brew, see what it comes up with. The hard part with asking AI to put together a recipe for you is identifying how much of that is copied from, or just, you know, a straight copy of a published recipe elsewhere.
Let me solve that for you. All of it.
Well, to an extent, right? I think you can get it, and if you prompt it correctly, and if you do correct it, I think you can get it to a point where you can say, okay, this is original. Well, as original as any recipe is, because obviously, like, it's a given, there's a finite number of ingredients, there's a finite quantity, you know, but it's still...
There's a finite arrangement of those
Exactly. Right. And there's only a finite arrangement that is going to be quite palatable. So within those constraints, yes, I think it would be, you could get an original one out of it, but actually making sure that it didn't just cut and paste one from somewhere. I think that's the challenging part, just make sure that it wasn't just, oh yeah, I found this recipe on this website, here it is.
Yeah.
So I think I'll do it. I'll give it a go, but I haven't had a chance, but I definitely need to do it. So I need the time, the energy, the money, the desire, and I'll get it done. I just need everything. And in the meantime, I'm just going to be drinking down to my mountain cultures.
Yeah, good idea.
So you've given us the history of the CPUs and the GPUs and where we are today. Not just for gaming, but AI and everything else. I don't know what that holds for the future for us, Matt, and where it goes. I think you've kind of shone a light on, you know, maybe there's a gap opening up for a few more players in the market, which is quite promising. So we'll see where this takes us over the next few years.
I think the key thing is that it is going to be interesting finding out. It's not all doom and gloom, and that the prices are out of control and they're never going back down. Something's going to happen. The players that are there now might win, they might survive, they might not. But they are proving categorically that the current kings can be dethroned. And that's what's interesting to me.
Well, I've just had thoughts that go through my head right now that are going to carry this conversation for another 2 hours. So let's just leave it at that. Say, I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Let's do it.
All right. Do you want to kick us off?
No, not really. Let me crack open another beer.